With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom. Simply visit www.realitycheck.radio/donate to make a difference today.
Professor Ramesh Thakur is a Brownstone Institute senior scholar, a former United Nations Assistant Secretary General, and emeritus professor in the Crawford School of Public Policy at the Australian University. Now, we had Professor Thakur on this program towards the end of December last year, and we were talking about his book. It was a new book at the time, Our Enemy, the Government, COVID, and the Expansion and Abuse of State Power. Now, Ramesh, along with Dr. David Bell, former World Health Organization medical officer and scientist, we've also spoken to him a number of times here on this program at RCR, will be in Auckland Friday, May 17th, 7 p.m., Auckland Central. Tickets will be available soon, so keep an eye out through the normal channels, social media, if you're one of our foundation members, through emails, etc., for when you can buy tickets to see Professor Ramesh Thakur, former United Nations Assistant Secretary General, Dr. David Bell, former World Health Organization medical officer and scientist, 17th of May, so this coming Friday. Keep an eye out for when you can buy tickets, available soon, and the venue, etc. And this is an RCR presentation. So I'd like to welcome Professor Thakur back to RCR. Nice to have you here. Thanks for making a bit of time for us, and we're looking forward to catching up with you when you get here.
Thanks, Paul. It's a pleasure to be back. And by the way, this will be David's first visit to New Zealand. So welcome him.
Have you given him any heads up on what you think he might expect when he gets here?
Oh, yeah. I met him when I went to Dallas in November, and we had we spent the day together so far.
Yeah, well, he's an Australian, so he's sort of like that. All right, I want to start off by just reading a couple of paragraphs from one of your pieces on brownstoneinstitute.org at the end of March. The title of your piece is "The WHO Wants to Rule the World." It sounds like a Tears for Fears song. Everybody wants to rule the world. And you say, the World Health Organization, WHO, will present two new texts for adoption by its governing body, the World Health Assembly, comprising delegates of 194 member states in Geneva, 27th of May, so not too far away to the 1st of June. The amendments to the international health regulations can be adopted by a simple majority. Because they will be changes to an existing agreement that states have already signed, the amendments do not require any follow-up ratification. The WHO describes the IHR as an instrument of international law that is legally binding on its 196 states' parties, including the 194 WHO member states. Even if they voted against it, therein lies its promise and its threat, Professor Thakur says. Okay, let's start off with the title. The WHO wants to rule the world. Do you really think they do want to do that?
On health policy. I mean, you, as a journalist, will know that titles of articles are rarely chosen by authors. That is handed over to the publication concerned and their sub-editors. So I can't know. I can't remember what exactly I had suggested, but it might have been that, it might not. But certainly, look, the reality is, since the creation of the United Nations in 1945, state conduct has increasingly had to conform to international standards and benchmarks. And most of these standards and benchmarks have been set by some entity in the UN system. That tendency has increased since 1945. This is part of that. It's the WHO was set up to assist in particular developing countries with technical expertise and financial assistance from generous donor governments. As happens with most bureaucracies over time, the original mission clarity has been to some extent compromised by its own corporate interest in expanding resources, gaining more powers and authority. And this is part of that trend.
That's next level as far as trends go, though, isn't it? We're talking next level now.
We are. But let me put it this way. before the UN Charter in 1945, the ability or the authority to go to war against any other country, both for offensive purposes as well as defensive purposes, was an acknowledged and accepted attribute of state sovereignty. In signing the charter, states gave up that part of sovereignty. Similarly, in 1968, we negotiated the NPT, the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. And in signing the NPT, New Zealand, like Australia, and approximately 180 plus other states, gave up their hitherto sovereign right to get the bomb. Now, of course, we could nonetheless exercise sovereignty, withdraw from the treaty, and get the bomb. But that would put us offside with the rest of the international community, and it would arguably also be illegal unless there were exculpatory events. So the UN community still does not accept the legitimacy of North Korea having withdrawn in 2006, even though it has 50 bombs by now. So that distinction between legally binding and loss of sovereignty that the WHO still makes and that the Director General makes, I think is a distinction without a difference. For practical purposes, the capacity to exercise sovereign rights with regard to health policy will undergo a significant transfer from national governments to the WHO, and we will voluntarily surrender those rights.
It's the epic overreach, isn't it? Like it's the king of all overreaches, if you want to see it like that.
Well,
where do you think these people get the confidence to do this?
Well, let's look what's what happened in the last 4 years. How many governments handed over all effective health decision-making powers to the national bureaucrats and experts? Now, you know, there's a reason we have a minister of health, and there's a reason we have cabinet governments. And the Minister of Health's responsibility is to look at the entire breadth of health policy, not just any one disease. And the responsibility of the Prime Minister and the Cabinet is to look at the entire breadth of public policy, not just health policy. But they lost all sense of proportionality, and the governments became obsessively focused on COVID, and we went to excesses and suffered in consequence. The WHO was part of that. So the broader point I'd like to make is this. Pandemics are very rare events, first. Second, the disease burden of pandemics considered in the entirety, let's say, since the Spanish flu, but including the Spanish flu, is actually surprisingly low. In the developing countries, the big killer diseases remain malaria, TB, HIV, AIDS, cholera, etc. In the high-income industrialized countries, by contrast, we have made enormous advances since the Spanish flu in our capacity to detect, to surveil, to catch, and to treat in various ways pandemics, so that the disease burden of pandemics is low even in industrialized countries. Consequently, there's a hugely out of proportion focus on pandemics, but that is the starting premise of the new accords. So first, I think we need to look at how well we did and how badly we did as governments, and how well and how badly the WHO performed in its COVID management. And they didn't do very well. They abandoned their own scientific consensus, as published by the WHO in a report as late as September 2019. So that's just a few months before the pandemic. So then we look at that, draw the lessons, and then say, okay, are there gaps in the global architecture of health policy? What's the best way of fulfilling those? And maybe in some respects, we want to limit WHO powers. In other respects, we may want to expand it. But until those studies are done that are honest, independent, powerful, and credible, until they're done, I don't think we need to proceed on the path. So I think we need to put the effort on hold and then make the reforms in light with the appropriate lessons, rather than going back to front saying, let's get the report, let's get the new architecture up, and then we'll see where we went wrong or where we went right.
You just said that pandemics are rare.
Yep.
Okay. Well, I can't remember.
Spanish flu, Asian flu, Hong Kong flu, avian flu, COVID. Can you name any other?
And that's a stretch of over 100 years.
More than 100 years.
So why does it seem then that we're being sort of bombarded with potential pandemics. They're like, they're raining down, or about to. Whereas a few years ago, no one ever, it never crossed anyone's mind over a span of 100 years. And suddenly, in 3 years, you know, we're under some kind of viral attack. What's all that about?
Well, they used to be much deadlier and they used to be more frequent. Enormous gains in hygiene advances, for example, in nutrition, in other respects, have extended life expectancy quite a lot. And they have correspondingly diminished in terms of gravity. Now, having said that, ironically, as it turns out, I was actually involved for several years when I was still in the UN system in trying to alert the world to the possibility of another major pandemic and saying we need to be prepared for that by having appropriate infrastructure and surge capacity and preparedness plans built in. So when the national pandemic preparedness plans were adopted and the WHO published its reports, I was quite happy with that. But then I think we have seemed to have swung in the opposite direction. So it's a question of keeping things in perspective, keeping things in balance, and not panicking. Look, if you have a new illness with worrying symptoms and you go to your doctor and your doctor reacts with panic rather than relax, calm and assurance, I think it's time to change your doctor.
But you go to the other doctor and he's panicking or she's panicking as well. It seemed a lot of them panicked.
Well, in this case, they did because it was led by the WHO. It was led by governments. And they engaged in deeply unethical psychological manipulation of their own citizens. Through fear porn.
Yeah. When I mentioned, you know, the rarity and then the actual rarity, but how it feels like, you know, we've got this sort of, you know, universe of pandemics approaching us. Is that part of the fear porn?
Well, it is. Look, at the very start of the pandemic, remember the Diamond Princess, the cruise ship? Left Hong Kong before we were aware of the pandemic, before we had been made aware. It arrived in Yokohama in Japan after we are aware of it. Some people got infected. From memory, the Diamond Princess had around 3,000 passengers and crew altogether.
The love boat.
Passengers were elderly people in very close interaction in confined places all the time. So the worst possible conditions. Despite that, of the 3,000 people on board, approximately 700 were infected, and a grand total of 14 died.
Okay. So thanks for reminding us.
And by contrast, two other ships, by the way, very interesting now. The USS warship, the Theodore Roosevelt, had about 4,000 people, also 700 infections, and only one died. The French warship, the Charles de Gaulle, just under 2,000 people, 60% infection by that date later on, not a single death.
That information was available.
It's available. It was available all the time. So, and this is hard data. This is not modeling.
So, okay, that's just ignored.
Yeah. Just like the WHO ignored the counterexample of Sweden and still does.
But that's, I don't understand why you would ignore that. That's like a gift, what would you call it, handed to you because you can see those numbers and you can extrapolate that out to a population, can't you?
Human beings, including their institutions and organizations, have an infinite capacity to ignore inconvenient facts.
Could you, if you don't mind, sort of lay out what you think, let's say all this goes through and we're living under this, what could life be like?
Okay. In July 22, the Director General, the present Director General, declared a global emergency, health emergency over monkeypox. Okay?
Yeah.
Do you know how many people had died in the world when that was done?
Probably count them on one hand.
Literally, five. In a narrow demographic in one part of Africa. Then he lifts it 10 months later in May 23. So worldwide, the number of deaths in 10 months was 140 when he lifted it. Now, under the new accords, the Director General will have the sole discretion to declare a public health emergency of international concern and as a subset, a pandemic emergency. Once he does that, he has powers under the present text, drafts of the text, to tell governments what to do to ramp up production, to transfer resources. You'll have seen 2 days ago, the British government said they're not prepared to sign the existing draft because it has significant curtailment of sovereignty. They would be required to hand over pharmaceutical products, therapeutics, and vaccines made in the UK, 10% for absolutely free to the WHO, another 10% at profit-free prices. And they said, no, the British government will decide any products made in Britain, how much of that is needed for us, and how much we are prepared to give to others. So that's one specific example of a major government saying this is too big an infringement of sovereignty, we retain the right. So the DG has that authority. So if he was to declare equivalent of monkeypox as a complete farce in terms of the gravity of the threat, he would nonetheless acquire those powers to tell governments what to do and hand over money, hand over many products, and give them to some other countries. If we are prepared to accept that his judgment is as infallible as that in terms of the gravity of the crisis and the appropriate responses, fine. Our whole experience with COVID and then monkeypox indicates that that is not a good idea.
So we have a global pandemic of whatever the wording is of...
PHEIC, Public Health Emergency of International Concern.
Too many acronyms these days, I'll forget it immediately.
Just get the pronunciation right and say it's FEC.
FEC, yes, a lot of FEC. That's an Irish word, isn't it?
I don't... Something like that.
On the basis of 140, that was infections, right?
No, 140 deaths after 10 months worldwide.
Okay, out of the population of the globe, which is over 8 billion now.
Well, to put that in perspective, more than 500 Australians die on average every day. We reach 140 deaths in our road accidents in 6 weeks.
Yeah. Can't see how you would be able to sit down and make something out of this when there's obviously no there, yet.
And this is, by the way, this is the first example of the chief of the Global Health Agency making a unilateral declaration against the expert advice.
So much power in one person.
Mm.
What do you make of that? Why would that be?
Well, Paul, if I was chief of any agency and I had the discretionary authority to declare an emergency, as a result of which I could increase my size of personnel, I could increase my budget, and I could increase my powers, you think there might be some temptations built into that structure?
That's follow the money.
Not just the money, power as well.
Power.
I mean, bureaucrats, surprise, surprise, love to expand.
But it's just so obvious that it's just so over the top. I know I'm banging on about it, but I just don't get the psyche of it. But you've kind of explained.
There's another, if you want to get the psyche of it, where's the push coming from? In the WHO funding structure, you have now built-in distortions of priorities of the activities and built-in incentives for pharmaceutical companies and the countries that house the big pharma companies to declare these emergencies and direct resources into pharmaceutical products. You should look up how many billions Bill Gates' net worth increased by from 2019 pre-pandemic to 2022 as a result of the fact that the Gates Foundation invests a lot in vaccines and other pharma products. So the United States and Germany are probably the world's two biggest host countries for pharmaceutical products.
That's interesting. I want to jump in there because there seems to be this weird relationship between the United States and Germany. And I know there's Russia at play as well. It's a geopolitical problem separate from this. But, you know, you can go and blow up their gas pipeline and it doesn't seem to bother them. Do you think that there's something in the pharmaceutical relationship between, because it's $1 trillion industry, right? That's $1 trillion.
It's a massive industry and it has possibly the worst record in history in terms of actual serious criminal convictions and massive fines for having misled governments in the past, for having hidden certain things.
That's the cost of business, though, isn't it,
yeah.
Ramesh?
Yeah, cost of business. No, but it is. We should not forget that that's their record. Pfizer, for example, has still not revealed for independent analysis all the raw trial data it conducted in regard to its vaccines. Remember, originally they wanted to keep it hidden for how many years was it? I
forgot. 75.
Something like that.
So we're all dead, yeah. You know.
You know, it's possible to read the whole thing and approve it within weeks. But when it comes to releasing it, it takes them all that long to read it.
What do you make of the, just as an aside, because you mentioned that the AstraZeneca story out of, it's reported in the UK. Well, obviously it's significant, but is that a crack in the wall, you know, a creaking and groaning moment?
Well, thinking there's different cracks. I mean, I thought the bigger one actually was when was it? Was it last year or the year before? I think it was last year that Jeanine Small, the Pfizer executive, in testifying before the European Parliament, admitted, and that thing is available on videotape even now, admitted that Pfizer had never said that their trials showed that the vaccine stopped infection or stopped transmission. They hadn't checked for that. The test had been in regard to how serious the disease will get if you get infected, not whether you get infected and not whether you transmit it. And once she admitted that, all the entire case for vaccine passports fell apart completely. And yet government stayed with it. So back to your earlier question, well, why would they refuse to see the obvious?
Was she the speed of science woman?
That's right.
Yeah, I do remember that.
Which is an odd phrase as well, because science actually proceeds very slow speed. It takes years and years.
It's kind of a powerful messaging, because people would buy that. Oh yeah, well, things move so quick now. You know, we didn't know what we had, and you know, what were we to do? So that's actually quite a clever line to use in a way.
Yes, but think it through again. Suppose we have genuine uncertainty, which we didn't in this case because of the Diamond Princess and other data that we had already. But suppose we have genuine uncertainty, and we have a real threat of a serious, grave new pandemic outbreak. In those conditions, you have promise of a revolutionary new platform for delivering vaccines, and you want to take advantage of that rather than wait indefinitely. Fair enough. If you then grant emergency use authorization, I can live with that, provided you become extra vigilant compared to normal procedures in monitoring side effects, in monitoring real-world safety and efficacy, as opposed to lab conditions. Now, technically, there is that distinction between efficacy, which is controlled experiments in the lab, and effectiveness, which is what happens when you roll it out. They're two different things. As you know from any number of inventions, once you actually go in the real world, sometimes they fail quite spectacularly. So they should have put in place far more robust monitoring and surveillance mechanisms. Instead, they just assume because we're given emergency use, it is the same as regular use. And they've disregarded evidence of harmful side effects from across the field. And the AstraZeneca thing comes into that. Just a few days ago, they were compelled to reveal in court documents, in some case in the United Kingdom, that yes, there are very rare cases of thrombosis that result from this vaccine. And this withdrawal worldwide follows from that. Now, you go back in time, some of the European countries withdrew the authorization for AstraZeneca vaccines for people under 40 quite early on, because there the risk of benefits versus side effects and serious benefits versus serious side effects did not compute as far as they could see. So the UK is amongst the last. The justification they've given for withdrawing is the sales no longer justify it, but that I think it's all interrelated.
Again, I think you were talking about mRNA as the platform, right? Okay. So as we're starting to know more, and you know, this has been talked about for quite some years now, a couple of years at least, this operates at a cellular level, okay? The nanolipid particle gets the, I think I got that right. I should know all this off the top of my head. I've heard them so many times, these terms. I don't want to know them, but I've heard them. Into the cell, RNA, it looks like, along with a lot of other sort of foreign debris, though we don't know what it is, can write itself in to DNA. Is that correct?
Whether it's correct or not, I don't know. I mean, I would have to be
But the arguments
are that there are several arguments, starting with the fact that they did not test for side effects with in regard to cancers. They didn't test for side effects in regard to toxic effects of this. They said in the beginning that it will stay on site, on the injection site. Now, in fact, we know that there is extensive biodistribution throughout the physiological system, including in the reproductive organs for both males and females. They never tested, by the way, and they shouldn't. They're not allowed to, in terms of ethics, on pregnant women. They never tested in children. And yet, progressively, these were authorized for all these groups. So again, it's we knew from very early on that this virus is exceptionally, if not uniquely for a virus, steeply age segregated. So the elderly, if you look at the figures, I haven't seen New Zealand's, but I'd be surprised if it was that different. In Australia and most Western countries, the average death with COVID is at or above life expectancy.
Yeah, I've heard that.
So
yeah.
Most of the people who have died with COVID in the past 3 to 4 years would have been dead by now anyway, because you're typically looking at 6 to 12 months after life expectancy for most people to pass away anyway. But the side effects, on the other hand, are disproportionately concentrated quite often in the younger people, depending on which side effect we are looking at.
Gosh, it worked well then, didn't it?
The balance was generally right between the benefits of vaccines and the risks. And same with the lockdown, school closures. Look at the damage it has done to a generation of school children the world over, but particularly in developing countries. UNICEF, in a report last year, pointed out that the number of children worldwide up to age 5 who have missed out on at least one dose of the necessary vaccination, recommended vaccination, that number is 67 million.
Wow, okay.
Causes, disruptions in supply, inability to get to things, health workers not working, not going to home, house to house to in the campaign, etc. Multiple causes, all in relation to lockdowns.
The point I was going to make about mRNA was, again, it's this confidence in doing things next level to interfere potentially with actual genetic codes. Is any common sense thinking person knows that that is potentially so incredibly risky, yet it's like, well, you know.
And that is there's also another aspect to that that's interesting. You know how in recent years in several Western countries, we have departed from biological definitions into legal definitions in determining whether someone is male or female.
Yeah.
And if the law says someone is female for whatever reasons and circumstances they say, then you have to accept that and you can be fined and perhaps even imprisoned for misgendering or dead naming or whatever. Similarly, there's an argument that some of the people in Australia are making that regardless of what the scientists might say in terms of scientific reasoning, on the legal reasoning, on the laws that actually exist, these vaccines are much more clearly GMOs, genetically modified organisms, rather than vaccines. And that means that they required approval through that process for GMOs, and that was never sought, let alone given. So that there is a potential legal liability issue that arises from that. So there are all those issues. Now, as I said, I don't know. I think in principle, if mRNA technology and platforms have a massive positive potential, well and good. We have benefited from advances in medical science. There's no reason we cannot continue to benefit from that. But for heaven's sake, let us not soften our standards of testing, both in terms of efficacy and effectiveness on the one side, and the collateral harms and side effects and damage they can do on the other. So why we abandoned things like cost-benefit analysis, why we abandoned our long-standing metric of QALY, the quality-adjusted life years, in determining priorities, and saying, well, let's focus on the elderly and the most at risk, and make sure that all of them get it. and why we ignored the fact that from the start, these were not meant to stop infection or stop transmission. Had they proven to do so, we might have been pleased, but they were never tested for that. And so the imposition of vaccine mandates, I think, has had a major detrimental impact, which was predicted by many of us at the start, and that is it has increased vaccine hesitancy. And the suppression and silencing of critics and those who are trying to warn against this, no matter how internationally eminent they were as scientists, that has reduced faith in public health institutions and officials as well.
Who's pushing back? You mentioned the UK. Who else
do we know? Well, in the United States, you had a group of, in fact, all Republican senators, all 49 of 100 senators from the Republican Party have written to the president formally saying they are opposed to it and the United States should not sign these. And 22 attorneys general have written to the president saying that the WHO thing will not be allowed to rule the roost in their states. There's a couple of other countries that did enter reservations by the end of last year. I think New Zealand has said it, some aspects of it that it's concerned about and hasn't.
We have to do a national interest test. It hasn't been done yet.
So I think it's for the first time you get the sense that politicians are starting to focus now that the deadline is here, that they have simply assumed this is all good faith. The experts know what they're doing. They saved millions of lives during COVID, et cetera. Pretty much all those conclusions are questionable. And as if you look at the hard data as opposed to modeled estimates and future projections and what happened in the past, most of the claimed benefits become dubious. The harms are much easier to recognize. And the economic, social, mental health, and educational harms will be felt for many, many years still, particularly by the young.
Yeah, the young. Let's say they get their fevered dreams through,
okay,
and the world ends up operating in this way, you know, with the international health regulations, the pandemic treaty. For those who reject it, does that mean they become pariahs?
It depends who they are and how many they are. We saw the example of the United States under President Trump pulling out of the nuclear deal with Iran. This was a deal that had been negotiated by a cross group of people, countries including China and Russia and Germany and the EU, as well as the five permanent members of the Security Council. It had been unanimously endorsed by the Security Council. The IAEA had repeatedly certified that Iran was in compliance with the terms of that deal. The United States breached international law, therefore, and defied the UN Security Council unanimous endorsement by pulling out. But we never expected any consequence to the United States because it's too big to punish. So if the rest of the world signs on and the US says no, that's a big, big hole right there. If other countries also say no, and depending on who they are, if they are generally good UN citizen states, it will have serious erosion of legitimacy and credibility. By contrast, you can have an odd situation like the nuclear ban treaty, where the legitimacy is there because majority of countries have adopted it and it is in force. But the effectiveness is at the moment, in terms of practical outcome, non-existent because all the countries that have the bomb have stayed out of it. So it does depend on who, which group of countries, how soon or how late in the day they say, no, this isn't working. It was not such a good idea.
Because I can just see with a country our size, Australia's, you know, bigger scale, but we're Melbourne, basically, that if, let's say, we rejected it, United States accepted it, so that line is crossed, the point you just made, that will curtail travel, freedom of movement for citizens. They'd still have to partake in this passport system, wouldn't they? They'd still have, otherwise...
If there is an emergency.
If there is an emergency.
So they have that right. But if it's a treaty, then New Zealand has not signed and is not bound by it. That's fine.
Right, but we might still be punished for it.
Not that that's going to be hard. It's hard to foresee that. I think.
Yeah. Well, they're nasty people, Ramesh. So they do nasty things.
Yeah, but I'm not sure I'd go quite that far. I think the more problematical thing will be countries that don't vote to adopt the changes to the IHR, the International Health Regulations, but it does get adopted and then we are bound by it. Then what do we do? All you need is a simple majority for the amendment. So 196 votes, whatever it is, half of that, it gets approved. So that's 98, 99 vote in favor, and the others don't. Even if you're saying no, you're still bound by it. It's, you know, like the Security Council. If it passes a resolution, even a member of the Security Council that voted against it is bound by it. So that's what legally binding means. Now, you have the sovereign right not to take part, but there will be consequences for that. And those consequences might be along those lines. I found myself once in a country where, as a UN official that suffered a big terrorist attack on the night I was there. And I was told by the UN security coordinator for that area that I had to leave. And I said, I can't because I've got an important meeting and the others are not leaving because their embassies are not saying to leave yet. And the answer was, well, if you stay, you lose your insurance for while you are here. And I said, okay, I'll take that risk. And I stayed. So there are consequences, and the consequences can occasionally be severe. But even for New Zealand, I think it's hard to foresee that other countries would willingly enforce punitive measures on New Zealand.
Okay, yeah. All right, just to finish up, and we're really looking forward to your visit, by the way. And you don't have to answer this, but
there will be consequences, okay.
Yeah. Where's your QR That's code? Right. What's your gut feeling as to how this will play out, how it will play through with everything you know, all that experience, all these nations, this WHO, all of that? How do you think this will end up? You got any views on that?
At this stage, I think it's going to depend mostly on the African Union.
Okay. Yeah.
They have concerns. They are the ones who blocked efforts to bring it about a couple of years ago, if you remember. They said, no, we need to look at it more. If they take the position that it's too rushed, it's not justified by the gravity of the threat to us, we need some more time before we decide on this, then I think it will be postponed. One final element in relation to that, there is an argument that there is a procedural irregularity involved by going to the vote in this month as it is, because for the IHR amendments, they are required to give 4 months period of review notice for a new text. And by giving the text last month, clearly it's not a 4 month that is met. Their argument is very close to gaslighting when they say, well, the original draft was released so many months ago. Well, you know, many of the original draft provisions have been dropped. So you have to look at the present thing. And again, I'm not sure that international lawyers would accept the argument, but what do you do if an international organization breaks its own rules?
Good question. Let's end on that. Again, we're looking forward to your visit with Dr. David Bell. Thanks for giving us a bit of time. And let's see what happens.
You're welcome, and I look forward to being there.
With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom. Simply visit www.realitycheck.radio/donate to make a difference today.